the biggest issues we're facing today. And we always work with social movements because we believe that the only way to change these things, and that we need more systemic responses, is to build political power, to build alliances with movements, and to push for the real solutions that we need to some of the biggest crises we face today.
Well, I really appreciate you taking the time, Nick. I know you're heading off on vacation tomorrow, so I thank you for being available today. And I'm going to keep up on TNI, so that maybe you might like to come back sometime in the future. I'll keep up with some of the your blog post and other writings that appear on the website.
Great.
And I want to let
keep up the great work. I'm a strong supporter of community radio, so I think it's great that you're sharing these news. I think community radio is where you can get this kind of analysis and stories that often doesn't break through into the mainstream media, and so they're really important. So keep up the good work.
Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Nick. Yes, that was Nick Buxton with the Transnational Institute. And how's everything going there in the studio, John?
Well, we had a couple hiccups going on in here, but we've got it all figured out now so far. You're coming off really well now.
Yeah. Can you hear me okay, John?
Yes, I can. You're coming on strong. Yep. Yes.
Very good. Well, we have a second guest coming up momentarily. He hasn't called in yet, but I'm going to introduce him so that you'll know exactly who he is. His name is Jeremy Kusmaroff, and Jeremy is the managing editor of Covert Action magazine. He's written several books. He has taught at numerous universities and colleges in the field of U.S. history and foreign relations. He has undertaken extensive specialized research on the following topics: covert dimensions of U.S. foreign policy, the war on drugs, U.S. policing and prisons, and the internationalization of the U.S. criminal justice system, U.S. air power and its human cost, American military base networks, the false manipulations of the public in selling American wars, among other topics. So Jeremy has contributed to many progressive publications like the Progressive Magazine, Counterpunch, the Huffington Post, and several others. He is also a contributor to a peace website. And as I said, he is the managing editor of the Covert Magazine. So you can go to covertactionmagazine.com. covertactionmagazine.com. And he is contributed many posts within the last 10 days to 2 weeks on the Covert Action magazine website. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to have John play a little music, if he can come up with something momentarily. And while he's doing that, I want to give Jeremy a call to make sure is a one-hour time difference between the East Coast and Oklahoma, where he is stationed. So I'm going to give him a call and make sure there's not a mix-up with the time zone difference, and hopefully have him on the air momentarily. And we'll see what John has lined up for us so that we can take a couple of minutes to contact Jeremy.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I quickly ran and got my little stack of music out, and of course, 90% of that is blues. So I'm going to be playing my hobby.
Hey, blues is fine. We're talking about peace and justice in the United States, John.
Yeah,
let's face it.
Okay, you're absolutely right. And
anything will do. Anything will do, because you have one of the best shows on WSLR every Monday morning, Blues to Bluegrass. So we give the give the listeners a sample of Blues to Bluegrass.
Okay, I can't find a listing on the soundboard for CD1, so I'm had to change over. Let's see. Come on, baby. There you go. All right, I'm still dealing with this, Bob. I'll have it for you in a second.
Okay, very good, very good. So if you want to follow along with this conversation that I'm going to have with Jeremy, what you can do is go to, as I mentioned, Covert Action Magazine, and there are several recent posts that he has. The one that is from July 22nd is activists risk prison in attempt to stop U.S. drone war. So that's the first one that I wanted to discuss with him. You okay, John?
I'm ready. You just give me the high sign.
Go ahead. Go ahead, John.
Okay. Let's see. CD2. Well, I don't know what's happening. Maybe the CD player is not working.
What we can do is I can continue to go to the next article. That's the first one I wanted to talk to him about. On April 19th, six peace activists, including three military veterans, were arrested for trying to block.
Yeah, he's not. He hasn't.
I can hear you, John. Jeez. Yeah, I can hear you just fine, John. Well, yes. Jeremy, can you hear me? Jeremy, are you, is your sound turned?
There. Yeah. Okay.
Oh, great. Great. I can hear you. I'm assuming John can hear you as well. Yeah. Jeremy, I just read a little, brief bio. You've been on before, and I referred people to Covert Action Magazine. And I had mentioned I was going to have you talk about the piece you had just written the other day relating to the six peace activists who were who have a case pending against them. Could you talk about that piece that you that's on sure. the on your on the COVID Action magazine website?
Absolutely. Well, thanks for having me, and thank you for promoting COVID Action magazine. And yeah, this piece looks at the Holloman Six. These are six seasoned peace activists who were arrested in April for trying to block the entrance to the Holloman Air Force Base. And that base was selected because that's where they train drone pilots. And many of these activists have been involved in protests at the Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, which is kind of infamous as a center for the drone war. And, you know, the activists, like many of us, are outraged by the use of drones, robots that kill humans around the world. And there's evidence, you know, drones are being used quite extensively in the Gazan conflict, where we've seen the Lancet report, the distinguished medical journal, raised the possibility that the death toll is as high as 186,000 in Gaza. Drones are used extensively in Ukraine. They're also being used in the Middle East still, in Somalia, the dirty war going on there, and Africa. And there, you know, who knows how many covert operations we don't know about are not being reported. So, and this is, I think, the activists emphasize a very cowardly instrument of killing people, kind of anonymously from the sky. And, you know, Toby Blome was one of the activists who was arrested, whom I interviewed. And she said, she really admired Daniel Hale, who was one of the few drone pilots to dissent against these operations. And he leaked documents to The Intercept that showed that 9 out of 10 of the victims were civilians. So they're not often even hitting their intended target. Many civilians, and since drone warfare was introduced in the early 2000s, drones have killed who knows how many thousands of people, many innocent, and those people were never had a trial. If some of them were targeted because they carried out terrorist activity, but they were never put on trial. We don't know if they're guilty, and this is doing away with the rule of law. It's just a lawless instrument. That where the president, because Obama had bragged when he was president that he would select the targets, but there's no judicial process, and he just kills whoever he wants, and he was killing even U.S. citizens, Anwar Awlaki and his kid. They killed not just Awlaki, who had never put on trial. In that case, he may have been guilty of terrorist activity, but there was no trial. And then they murdered his 15-year-old son. So, and then somebody in the administration said, well, he was born to the wrong father. I mean, what kind of logic is that? This is really perverse. And what was interesting is that Toby, whom I interviewed, is one of the six who, I think her case is pending. They'll probably get at most community service. I don't think they're going to serve, thankfully, any jail time. But and she said, you know, people everywhere were sympathetic, even on the military base. You know, one woman who worked there hugged her. I think even people in the military, they're just there to make a living. You know, it's a tough economy, and the military has good benefits, and they have to put their kids through school. A lot of the students I taught joined the military simply because they were paying for their education. But if you talk to the people, a lot of them were sympathetic to the protesters, and one woman gave her a hug and said, I can't wait till I get out of the military. I think a lot of them don't even want to do this. They're just there because it's a tough economy. And, you know, they put these bases in very, very remote areas to try and keep it secret from the public, because most rational people don't want to do this. We don't want to go killing people around, far from our home for no reason. And it just angers people, and it's going to cause more violence and terrorism. It's not solving any problems.
With that being said, I know you had mentioned the military and the soldiers who were involved in this. And I can remember being at the big protest in Washington, D.C. in 2011, the beginning, Freedom Occupy movement, and we were out in front of the building where the drone activities were actually originating from. So this is as you said, it began in really for in the Obama administration. That's when it really became prevalent, and it's a sad state of affairs when innocent people get killed at a wedding party because you're looking to find one person. And unfortunately, I talked to a friend last week who had mentioned he has a couple of relatives who live in Israel. And I was saying, isn't it tragic that hospitals and universities are being targeted by the Israeli pilots? And he said, well, if there's Hamas hiding under the building, what can you do? Now, what kind of rationale is that, Jeremy?
Well, in that case, I think that it's evident that the Israelis actually funded, created Hamas back in the 80s and financed them, because particularly the Israeli right didn't want a peace process. And they didn't want, you know, they were worried about the growing strength of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, which was a secular, secular nationalist organization. And they didn't want a two-state solution and a peace process where they would have to make concessions. So they wanted to divide and weaken the Palestinians, and they supported militant factions, and that could rationalize permanent warfare. And, you know, there's a military-industrial complex in Israel, like in the United States, that wants permanent war and that profits off permanent war, and a billionaire class that's been bankrolling Netanyahu, who's a man of war and genocide. Now, as far as that argument, I mean, they used that argument in Vietnam. They claimed, oh, well, the Vietnamese communists used human shield, and that justified pulverizing North Vietnam. I mean, they always use that argument, but at the end of the day, I mean, Hamas is a representative of the people because, I mean, there's an absence of historical consciousness among a lot of people with regard to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, like other conflicts, including Vietnam. I mean, the Palestinians were thrown off their land. I mean, you know, the Jews were oppressed historically. And I can understand the rationale for the Zionist movement, but there were two, you know, wings of the Zionist movement. There was one wing that respected the Palestinian as human, and that they have to find a mean of coexistence if Jews want to have their own state or settle in Israel. And many promoted a binational state. But then you had the hardliners, you know, including Netanyahu's father, Ben Zion Netanyahu, who were tied in with European fascism and had this, you know, Jewish supremacist attitude and didn't care at all, you know, regard the Arabs in a very pejorative, often racist way. And they pushed them off their land. You know, many of the Gazans were relocated in Nakba, and, you know, Gaza had been part of Egypt, and then the Israelis, you know, occupied that territory after the Six-Day War, and they, you know, sustained a harsh occupation. And, you know, in recent years, they've imposed very harsh economic measures and tried to isolate them and destroy their economy. So, I mean, if you impose those kind of policy, they're going to fight back naturally. And again, there were more liberal, humanistic elements in Israel, but unfortunately, they lost ground politically, and they've been repressed. I mean, it's a fairly oppressive society now, not the model democracy they claim. And they've mistreated those people for decades now. So, you know, they're going to rise up, and the people are going to support any kind of political movement that fights back for their people's interests and dignity. So I think, you know, a lot of Israelis miss the historical context. They don't want to accept any responsibility for mistreating the Palestinian, just like in the United States, American settlers mistreated the Native American and pushed them off their land and onto reservations. And the Indian of their day, Geronimo, was called a terrorist. So, you know, history does repeat itself.
Well, I know you had written another piece for the magazine back on July 13th. For 75 years, NATO has been terrorizing the globe. So we did have David Swanson on the show back the end of May talking about the book he had written with Medea Benjamin. So do you want to go into that piece a little bit? And
sure. Well, and that was basically a review of his book, which was very informative, and I would highly recommend to help educate people about NATO and what it's been doing for the last 75 years. And, you know, it was set up as a defense. It was, the claim was that it was a defense alliance against Soviet aggression. But if you go back in that era, there was great exaggeration of the Soviet threat. I mean, the Soviet Union had been devastated in World War II in an unprecedented way after their heroic fight and defeat of the Nazis, where they really took the lead in defeating the greatest evil force in world history. And Douglas MacArthur said that this was the greatest military achievement in all of history. But they lost 25 million people, and their infrastructure was totally devastated. So, I mean, to think that they would start a new world war again, or engage in any kind of military aggression against Europe and fight. I mean, the United States had supported, through the Lend-Lease program, had supported the Soviets, and the countries had a good friendship. You know, Franklin Roosevelt was a visionary leader in many ways, and Vice President Henry Wallace, and he understood that the U.S.-Soviet relations were key to world peace. Now, unfortunately, they removed Henry Wallace when Roosevelt got ill. Wallace was supposed to succeed him, but just like now, you know, the candidate this cycle was anointed, not elected, and that's what happened in 1944. Wallace was the popular choice. He would have ushered in an era of peace after World War II, and instead there was a coup. The kingmaker in the Democratic Party orchestrated a coup, put in Harry Truman, who was a simpleton from Missouri, immoral person connected with the Pendergast organized crime dynasty in Missouri, who had bankrolled his political career, and they knew that they could control him, and that they could advance a Cold War, which would benefit the interests of the armed manufacturers and Wall Street banks. and they set up NATO, under the illusion of a defense alliance, but really it was an offensive alliance to promote the American century and American empire around the world, which Wallace had wanted to close down U.S. overseas military bases and focus on creating a better society at home, you know, creating Medicare for all and progressive social program domestically. But, yeah, again, he was removed. So NATO was created and it engaged in aggressive conduct in the Cold War year. You know, it was involved in the Korean War, which was basically a Holocaust where a significant percentage of North Korea's population was killed, and North Korea was bombed back to the Stone Age. You know, the illusion was always this Soviet threat to justify its expansion. And then at the end of the Cold War, you know, and Swanson, a lot of his book focuses on the last 30 years or so. I mean, there was no real purpose when the Cold War ended. The purpose of NATO dissipated, so they had to find new pretexts for war and its expansion. And the Yugoslav conflict was very vital in the 90s. And, you know, they played up the Serb aggression and Serb genocide. But in fact, the Serbs have been trying to keep the Yugoslav Federation together. And the worst atrocity, there were, you know, ethnic violence on all sides of that conflict, but the worst ethnic violence was carried out by the Croats, and that was a staunch U.S. ally, and the U.S. was supporting Muslim extremists, but that war gave justification for NATO at the end of the Cold War, and that was a NATO-run operation, and they bombed, they killed a lot of civilians in bombing Bosnia and bombing Serbia, and the U.S. then acquired military bases at the end of that conflict. And that, you know, antagonized the Russians. And the Russians had been promised that NATO wouldn't expand. You know, George H.W. Bush administration had promised Gorbachev and at the end of the Cold War that NATO wouldn't be expanded. But then Clinton expanded NATO to three countries. And you had old Cold Warrior like George Kennan warning against that and said that would create a new Cold War, would antagonize the Russians. But they didn't listen to Kennan. And they, you know, Bush, one administration, expanded NATO into numerous other countries. And, I mean, that's a key factor in the Ukraine conflict. And that's a red line for Russia, had been the, you know, Ukraine incorporation into NATO. And they seem hell-bent on pursuing that. And, you know, NATO has played a vital role in the Ukraine conflict, which is another, you know, humanitarian catastrophe that's wiped out a generation of Ukrainian youth. And, I mean, this is threatening a world war. NATO is pushing its military activity into Russia proper and threatening Russia directly now. So we could very easily have the outbreak of a major world war, or World War III, or nuclear war. And that underscores the danger of the NATO alliance, that it's this aggressive anti-Russia body that has provoked wars, caused, you know, violence. I mean, Swanson goes into other NATO operations like Libya, where they coordinated bombing operation that killed who knows how many thousands of people and just devastated that country. It's a menace to world peace, and people around the world view NATO and the U.S. as the greatest threat to world peace. And I remember at the end of the book, he has some statistics that actually Republicans are more skeptical. Republican voters in the United States are the ones more skeptical of NATO. Democrats overwhelmingly favor NATO. And I said in my review that underscored the importance of organizing in liberal, you know, perhaps the propaganda of the warfare state has targeted liberal media. So as peace activists, we have to target liberals and expose to them the true history. Like I said, that Swanson's book is a good tool for educating people about the truth behind NATO and U.S. foreign policy. And we need to educate and organize and build a movement for peace and against NATO.
Well, thank you for that review. That's great. Yeah, we're speaking with Jeremy Kusimov, who is the managing editor of Covert Action Magazine. And you can go to covertactionmagazine.com and read all of his articles, as well as many others who contribute to the magazine. There's another piece that you just came out with July 6th, the new VP pick of Donald Trump. The sugar daddy of Trump's VP pick has deep ties to the CIA. Do you want to give a brief synopsis of that piece?
Sure. Well, yeah, J.D. Vance, his career was had been supported, and he has very close ties with Peter Thiel. And Peter Thiel is a Silicon Valley billionaire who was an early investor in Facebook, which Facebook has a very close connection with the CIA, and I believe their first CEO or some people in very high position in Facebook were tied to the CIA, because the CIA was promoting Facebook because, you know, people put up information about themselves, including their political affiliations or personal information. So it makes it much easier for the intelligence agencies to amass dossier on people and spy on people. So it may have been a brainchild of the CIA from the beginning. And then Thiel is also a co-founder of Palantir, which is a surveillance company that was also found in the early 2000s with CIA seed money from InQtel, which is the CIA venture capital firm. And its main clients was the CIA for the first years of its operation. And Palantir develops these surveillance, has surveillance software and technology. And it's a major war profiteer. Like Palantir, Thiel and the other, another executive, Alex Karp, visited with Zelensky and secured major contracts in Ukraine, and they provide battlefield intelligence for the Ukrainian military. And I think they also have extensive contract with the Israeli government. So, I mean, this is a major spy software. They've been involved with also spying on immigrants within the United States. So, you know, this is the surveillance state and the warfare state. I mean, major war profiteers and how it's also connected with big tech and Silicon Valley. So, you know, Vance presents, I mean, I think he's this kind of Manchurian candidate. Obviously, you know, well, apparently he first got connected with Thiel when Vance was a student at Yale Law School. And then Vance went to work on Silicon Valley and various startup tech firms, I think associated with Thiel. And then Thiel, you know, contributed a huge amount of money to his political career, so, and campaigned for the U.S. Senate. So, I mean, basically, this is a kind of Manchurian candidate who has CIA, Silicon Valley, huge money behind him. Obviously, they bankrolled this book. You know, I think nowadays, to be a national political candidate, you need a kind of compelling personal story. And, you know, Obama had this memoir. And, you know, most people, you know, somebody, you know, powerful is pushing Vance, just like Obama, because who in their 30s writes a memoir?
Right.
I mean, they haven't established, you know, anything about themselves, and why would anybody want to read that memoir? But, you know, Obama, and I wrote a whole book on Obama and his family's connection to the CIA, and they created this story about his family that, if you look into it, is actually largely distorted, and there's half-truths, a lot of the half-truths in that book, and Obama completely whitewash his family's connection to the CIA and Indonesian, because his mother worked for Ford Foundation in Indonesia during for the Suharto government, and that committed genocide during the Cold War in the 1960s, and his mother was involved, complicit in certain ways in that genocide, and Obama completely whitewashes that. One aspect of the distortion. But you know, in each case, they're creating a personality that I think Obama was meant to embody, this, you know, growing multicultural society, and people could identify with that story of, you know, different cultures in his family. In the Vance case, you know, it's hillbilly elegy that he's this guy from, you know, Appalachia who grew up in a dysfunctional family. And he experienced the deindustrialization and the pathologies of life, you know, in rural America. And, you know, he can identify with the plight of the white working class and the, you know, dispossessed class.
A good story. Sounds like a great guy.
Yeah. So, I mean, it creates this personality as somebody who can empathize with those people. And, you know, he comes from them and he can develop solutions. But in reality, he's connected, you know, he went to Yale Law School, and he's connected with the elite and the surveillance and the warfare state. And actually, the book, people have analyzed it, it presents actually a very conservative message, focus on, like, individuals. And, you know, the only way to get out of that is through, you know, hard work and getting off drugs or something. But there's nothing as far as...
I hate to interrupt you, Jeremy, but we only have, like, 20, 30 seconds left,
The big picture story is that they created this persona of him, but really he's connected to the warfare and the surveillance state, and he's going to advance those policies.
Yeah, well, we're not surprised, are we? We're not surprised, are we? Well, I really appreciate your being on today, Jeremy, and hopefully back sometime in the near future. So. Absolutely.